My wife, the director of this illustrious club, the RACV, and therefore I insist that you all avail yourselves of the wonderful wines and refreshments during my speech. I won't consider it rude at all. Many of you have just received your certificates and your badges for jobs well done, so please, on your feet, go back. The staff are waiting, and this will take 40 minutes with me up here. You're going to get thirsty. Might be a bit of a wild ride, so I'd encourage you to avail yourself of the refreshments. Now, I'll introduce myself while you're also doing that. I'm Australia's biggest electoral loser. I've run for 30 different public company boards over the years. I've had $200 billion worth of stock voted against me in various corporate elections. I've run against Jeff Kennett in his old seat, against Peter Costello in his seat. I've run for Melbourne Lord Mayor. I've run for anything that moves. And the basis of that, the reason for doing that, is I was a journalist, and now I'm, I guess, what you might call a commentator, an internet gadfly, and a shareholder activist. So particularly in my shareholder activism, I try and create a culture of shareholder pressure. So what I do is I buy shares in any company of vague interest. So I've bought shares in 650 companies. I have the world's biggest small share portfolio, 650 stocks, just sold a few this afternoon, so not even worth 180 grand. So my average holding in each stock is about $300. And that gives me a torrent of information coming down from listed companies about all that they're up to. And from that perspective, I then use that information, travel around to AGMs, gather the audio from those AGMs, make videos about it, go on the radio and talk about it, write newsletters about it. I'm also doing a book. I basically disseminate information across a wide variety of platforms, with the overall goal being to try and improve governance, particularly in corporates, but also within the media and within politics, and in the case of the shareholder activism, to create a greater culture of shareholder pressure. So my perspective is that Australia's got a bit of a go-to-the-beach culture. She'll be right, mate. And from my 10 years as a business journalist, I was a business editor of the Herald Sun. I used to do the Rear Window gossip column on the Fin Review. Went to a lot of AGMs and was disappointed that there was never as many questions as we saw tonight at your AGM. So the AGMs that I used to go to, you know, just no debate, question shareholders, you know, getting fleeced, losing companies, losing billions, and basically often usually old retirees, a fair collection also of eccentric nutters often who come to AGMs who haven't got much else better to do. They come for the tea and bickies, and the debate is terrible. The debate has been terrible. So I took a position that it's time to try and get some more energy and debate into AGMs. So I started off by going along and asking questions. And then I found that you could, you know, no matter how good your questions were or how lively it was, sometimes the press, you know, because I bag the press a fair bit as well, they then write you out of the story, and directors say, you know, like Kevin might have said a couple of times tonight, we'll take that on board, which is a common refrain, and then nothing much really happens. So what I try and do then is I'll then run for a board, so to try and put some pressure on. So for instance, in 4 weeks' time, I'm running for the Illumina board, which Illumina is a $5 billion company, which they own 40% of the AWAC joint venture run by Alcoa. Now, they're a postbox company. They've got 9 staff. They're basically a 40% stake in a global bauxite and alumina joint venture. So they've got six-person board and 9 staff, because they don't really do anything. They just let Pittsburgh and Alcoa run this venture. So for the last 4 years, I've been going along and saying, you guys are running a lunch club. You're paid the same as if you've got 20,000 employees. You have a board meeting each 2 weeks. It's a lunch club. You shouldn't be getting paid so much. You shouldn't have so many directors. And they say, yes, we hear you, Mr. Main. And then nothing happens. So this year, I decided to run for the board on that platform of lower board fees, smaller board, better value for money for the shareholders. So some of my tilts can be a bit eccentric. Like my favourite one was running for the board of David Jones on a platform that all shareholders get the same 35% shopping discounts that the directors get. And other ones, like with News Corp, Rupert Murdoch, the most powerful man in the world, you know, makes and breaks governments. Over 7 years in Adelaide, he had one question. from shareholders. One question in 7 years. So I went along, and I've been going along to all his AGMs for the last decade, so I've been to 9 of the last 10, and each year I have a great time with Rupert. I get up and ask a few questions and cause a bit of debate, and after a while I decided that you had to try and take it to the next step, because you'd have half an hour of debate with Rupert, would generate a fair bit of press, but again, he wouldn't really change his ways very much. So in 2002, I ran for the board of News Corp and nominally got elected from the floor. There were more yeses than againsts from the floor. So, of course, Rupert then had his 30% to vote and it was all over, but there I was on late line that night for 10 minutes as the guy who almost got on the News Corp board, and that gave me a platform to talk about Rupert's appalling governance, the fact that he's overpaid, the audit committee is not independent, all the various governance problems that are in News Corp gave me a chance to ventilate those out. Now last year I went to New York for the News Corp AGM, and for the first time in my life I put up a shareholder resolution. Now in terms of driving accountability, shareholder resolutions are fantastic, because basically you're putting up something to be voted on which isn't proposed by the board. So my shareholder resolution for Rupert was that we go to a one class share voting system, because Rupert, as I tell him every year, is running a gerrymander that would make Sir Joe Bjelke-Petersen blush, because 70% of the shares at News Corporation don't get a vote. So the world's most powerful man, who wants to bring democracy to Iraq, who campaigns for democracy all over the world, is actually running appalling democracy in his own company and controls 38% of the votes with 11% of the stock. So it's a shocking gerrymander. So I said, Rupert, let's vote for my resolution and we'll get a serious re-rating in the stock and you won't be able to hand over to your sons, which is what you want to do. And shareholders don't want that because there's only one Rupert. And come on, Rupert, rest on your laurels. You know, you're a legend. No one's going to vote you off. And this got supported by 40% of the stock. So little old me from Templestowe flying to New York, putting up a resolution, backed by $5 billion worth of stock, generates global press, pressures on Rupert to reform his governance structure and be more democratic. So it's a good example of how one little shareholder can actually get out there and make a small difference in terms of the way big companies are governed. Now, I have to say, I'm not particularly popular with what I do. You can imagine me going around saying some of these things. So a few quotes I've had over the years. Kerry Packer at the PBL AGM in 2000, quote, "Do you set out to be offensive or is it just natural?" Jerry Harvey at the Harvey Norman AGM 2001, "That's the first time anyone's ever interrupted our AGM. I'll get you later." No, he was quite friendly, actually. John Singleton at the 2005 AGM, "What are you going to bring up next, the assault charge?" And Alan Jones, just talking to a journalist, "People like Stephen Mayne don't deserve a place in society." So the other one was Eddie Maguire, "I wouldn't cross the street to give him a backhander, let alone a wrist." So I'm not out there to make friends, but I am out there to try and improve governance. And the story of the RACV actually is quite interesting, and I'll tell you about it because I'm here. For start, I just promise not to pass this on to the board, that'd be nice. I ran for the board here in 2002. You know, this is an old boys club. The directors have an average life length of service of 14 years. They're building a new Taj Mahal up here on Bourke Street, spending our money. They're not open and transparent enough, etc., etc. And I came fourth out of six, usual sort of a not last, but didn't get on. And then in 2005, I said to my beloved wife, "Oh, look, women tend to do better at the RACV, so why don't you be my running mate?" And of course, I'm being the biggest loser in the country. I come last, and my wife beats me, so I can't even be my wife in an election. So she got 20,000 votes, and I got 16,000 votes. So last year, or 2006, I said to her, "Listen, this time you run for the board, and if we can get another old fella as a running mate, and if it can be five old blokes and you, then you might be a chance to get elected." My wife's a family law barrister, presents well, nice CV. So lo and behold, she won. So this guy had been on the board since 1979. Was off. And some of the things that I've been campaigning on, such as board tenure limits, etc., has come in. So now all RACV directors have to sign and can only serve for 12 years. And then you're out. So that was a major reform that partly came from my pressuring about, you know, the length of tenure, and these guys have been serving for 20 and 30 years. And it's little things like that where you can actually make a small difference. Now, there's three or four past presidents on the board. They've just introduced a resolution which is outgoing chairs must resign after a further year. So you don't have this sort of jobs for life and past chairs still hanging around overseeing the governance. And I have to say, I've been really impressed. You know, once we've got inside the tent at the RACV, it's actually Australia's richest mutual. It makes $100 million a year. It's worth $2.5 billion. It's built the finest club in the country here. I was the one saying it's a Taj Mahal, but membership's gone from 16,000 to 26,000 since they built it. The motto, build it and they will come, applies to the RACV. And, you know, it's been a really good story, and from what I can pick up vicariously from my wife's position on the board, it actually runs very well. The committees are good. It is still the biggest board in the country, so 15 directors is pretty big. They're all on $80,000 a year, which is probably, for the total pool of directors, is probably a bit on the high side. But I, of course, can't say anything now that I'm conflicted and have an interest in this. But it is an interesting story about governance. And often you do find with mutuals that there isn't really anyone looking after the shareholders, that mutuals often get captured by their managements and their boards, who then extract disproportionately large benefits from them. We've seen it at the likes of the AMP, we've seen it at the likes of, you know, even the Colonials and these things when they demutualise, the NRMA. So it is a danger with mutuals, and I've been pleased from what I've seen at the RACV that they haven't really fallen into that trap. Now, just a couple of comments on the IT space. I'm very passionate about the importance of having Australian-owned companies and globally known Australian companies. And the IT space is one of the most disappointing sectors, that we don't have a single IT company in our top 100 stocks in Australia. And it was quite sad this week to see the news that Tower Software, which ran out of Canberra, has just been sold to Hewlett-Packard for about $120 million. And also that Myob is selling off most of their international operations under pressure from private equity proposals. So, it is slightly disappointing, I think, that we don't see more well-run, homegrown Australian IT companies, particularly listed on the stock market. Now, I must say that people like you in your professions have a very different approach to governance than me. My whole philosophy is I rely on public information. So I have mantras like disclose, 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 and sunlight is the best disinfectant. From my point of view as someone relying on the public disclosures, public information is everything. So I'm always pushing for greater transparency and greater disclosure, so there's more information from me and the media and the analysts and everyone from which to hold companies to account. And you, of course, are on the exact opposite side of that equation, where you're relying on and implementing the systems and processes within a company to ensure that things are run appropriately from a corporate governance point of view. So you're relying on systems, and you're relying on things like being well-resourced in your internal audit spaces. And I always think that internal auditors should be able to write their own budgets. It's very important that they don't get squeezed on the budgets. It's very important that you have the independent audit committee that you're reporting to. And of course, one of the great dangers you often see in corporates when they collapse is that the CEO with the big ego, the CEO who dominates, the CEO who micromanages. And it's very important for internal auditors to have a lot of integrity and a lot of determination to often take on important, powerful, strong, well-paid CEOs who are very dominating figures. And I think I'm going to run briefly through some of the recent corporate collapses and just talk about some of the characteristics of these companies that caused some of the troubles. And you'll see that the dominant, powerful CEO is often a very common theme when companies go under. Now, we are in a fascinating space right now in the governance debate. Nothing. This has been the last time this sort of thing happened was 2001. 2001, HIH, Pasminco, OneTel, and Ansett all fell over in the space of 6 months, and this caused a big backlash, particularly on the accounting side. Sarbanes-Oxley from the US, independent audit accounting changes in Australia, followed by the executive pay voting procedures that we saw introduced a couple of years after that. I think we're going to see a far greater and more dramatic regulatory response from the current series of collapses that have happened in the last 6 or 9 months. And I think part of that is driven by the fact that there's a change of government now, and the Labor Party won't have a such a laissez-faire approach to regulation as we saw from the Howard government over the years. Now, firstly, I'm just going to touch briefly on Centro. What went wrong? Long-serving CEO with a big ego, been in the job for 10 years. Identical board on the parent company and the retail trust. Of course, you should always have independent separate directors when you have a separate listed vehicle like Centro Properties Group as the headstock and Centro Retail Trust. They broke the cardinal rule on that. The audit committee only met twice in the previous year at the headstock company, and they misclassified about $1.5 billion worth of debt in the original accounts that came out in August last year. Very opaque structure, very difficult to understand. Some cross-collateral obligations between the different structures, so you couldn't be sure whether liabilities would bounce back from one to the other. Management and staff highly geared into the stock, and then they just made some fundamental business errors with paying too much for US assets and taking on too much short-term debt. And since it's gone down, Andrew Scott's been paid $3 million for 3 months' worth, the CEO, and I was actually on Sky News talking about this last night, saying that because it was such a complex structure, this was actually just money that you had to pay to buy his corporation on a basis of where are the bodies buried. I mean, it was such a complex beast that he built, you literally had to pay for his corporation over a short period of time for the new CEO, the advisors, the banks, etc., to get their heads around this monster, this complex monster that he had created. And another big criticism is the chairman, Brian Healy, been on the board since 1983, hasn't uttered a word publicly since the thing fell over. So I even went to the Incitec Pivot AGM to say, because he's on that board too, to say, Brian, I think you should be quietly retiring from this one. You've blown $5 billion over there at Centro. He was a no-show there, and he hasn't publicly said a word at Centro. So for mine, you know, if that sort of thing happens, the chairman has to stand up and be publicly seen and publicly explain what's happened and be seen to be taking a role. And that certainly hasn't happened at Centro. So from my point of view, he should either go or he should stand up. He can't just be silently there. MFS, again, founders with big egos, came out of a colourful Queensland law firms. It's just the new breed of the White Shoe Brigade, MFS, a bunch of financial planners and colourful Gold Coast lawyers, no majority of independent directors, massive understatement of debts, again, the cross-collateral obligations with other listed and unlisted vehicles, again, executives highly geared into the stock, again, tried to be a mini-me Macquarie, paid too much for assets. The massive conflicts of interest, which came from being a bunch of financial planners who sourced a lot of their equity and a lot of their investments for their funds through high commissions and backhanders to planners. I think that MFS alone will cause a major backlash in a regulatory sense against financial planners, because you've now got the industry funds which don't pay commissions with their Labor mates in Parliament in Canberra, and you've got MFS, which is just a disgraceful example of conflicts of interest with planners, kickbacks, etc., etc. So I think that you will particularly see a hard reaction against them from the government. Masses of related party transactions, and they're in complete denial. I went to the EGM last week in Melbourne. Andrew Peacock's the chairman, doesn't know the clue, just he's a door opener and got a good Rolodex, but no idea about a complex financial and property house such as MFS. He stood up at the EGM last week and said, I was going to resign today, but I've decided to stay for a few more weeks. And the CEO is facing a margin call. He's being sued by Citibank for $350,000 next week in the Magistrates Court in Queensland. So I got up, and when he started blaming fund managers and analysts for criticising the stock, I blew a gasket and basically got up and said, hang on a minute, you know, your chairman's walking out, you're getting margin called, you still haven't brought out your results, you've been suspended for 70 days, you're flogging everything off, you're in the hands of your receivers, this is a fire sale, your disclosure is appalling, you haven't got a majority of independent directors, and you're standing there blaming share market commentators. I mean, this is just a complete joke. So I think that MFS is going to go out the back door, and not before time. Allco, again, the death of the financial engineer. I think we've basically seen a 5-year credit boom globally, and the people who made the most money were the Macquarie banks, and I was the guy who came up with the nickname Millionaire's Factory back in 1997. I plugged away for a couple of years and no one ever copied it, and then it took off, and so now everyone calls them the Millionaire's Factory. So I ran for the Macquarie board once saying, you know, as the guy who came up with your nickname, surely I should be on your board. But they didn't buy that one. But also, again, misclassification of debt, short-term debt not properly disclosed. Again, dramatic executive chairman, big ego, founder of the company, still very hands-on in David Coe. No majority of independent directors. Business model that literally relied on related party transactions. So, again, this is sort of a Chatham House discussion, but I had a chat to Rod Edinson the other week. He's the lead independent director of Allco, and he basically confessed privately that the thing should never have gone public. That it was basically a private sort of investment house, and it should have stayed as such, because the whole thing just relied on deal making, and he was on the related party transaction committee that met 48 times last year. So, I mean, it was just not cut out for the public space. And again, they paid too much for assets trying to replicate Macquarie, and the structure was too complex. And I have to say that I've been getting into Rod a bit lately. I mean, there he is today telling Melburnians we've got to spend $18 billion on our new transport arrangements. He's also the lead independent director of Allco Finance Group, supposedly leading negotiations with the banks over $10 billion of debt across the group. He's also a director of Rio Tinto, fending off BHP. He's also the senior lead independent director of News Corporation. He's the bloke representing us against Rupert. He's also on the board of China Light and Power, which actually owns $5 billion worth of power assets in Australia. So ironically, as he's juggling questions about transport, he could have equally been answering questions about the power blackouts in Australia, because he's actually a director of one of those companies that keeps the lights on in Melbourne as well. And plus, he's chairman of Infrastructure Australia. He's just done the big review. He's chairman of Kevin Rudd's Business Advisory Group. He's chairman of Melbourne Major Events. He's on the board of Swire & Sons, which is, turns out about $400 million. The guy is the busiest man in Australia. Now, you can have a great reputation for running BA and being knighted and all that sort of stuff, but you just can't physically do it. And how on earth he was also keeping an eye on Allco, this complex beast, at the same time as he's literally riding the Doncaster bus two times to find out how fast it is to get to the city for his transport plan, whilst doing all this other stuff, you just can't do it. So I think Sir Rod is a great example of, no matter what your reputation, you cannot perform your duties as an independent director if you're overburdened with commitments. And there's no one more overburdened, in my view, than Sir Rod Eddington. Now, ABC Learning, again, founder of the company, strong-willed CEO, no majority of independent directors, three executives on the board, too many related party transactions. Eddie's brother-in-law did $100 million worth of construction and maintenance jobs on their childcare centres. The chairman of Austock, which was their stockbroking firm that raised all their money, is also on their board. Too many directors highly geared into the stock, accounting all over the place. Two-thirds of the claimed assets were goodwill. And when it all fell apart, they, of course, blamed short sellers, like everyone else does. And the evidence, Exhibit 1A, I give you as to why that is complete bollocks, is that the stock went from, what, $5 to $1.50, or a dollar low of $1.15, and then bounced back to $2.10, I think it was, and it's now back at $1.30. So if this really was short sellers driving the stock down to clean out the directors, the thing would be back at $4. That is, by definition, what has to happen. It's not. So basically, the board stuff that they took on too much debt, they were lucky to get rolled over last December, when the same banking syndicate was basically sitting there saying, Centro, yes or no, and ABC Learning, yes or no. And they said yes to ABC Learning and no to Centro. They struggled on for another few weeks, finally put the results out. It was a shocker. The thing tanked. Eddie's now the bloke who's blown up $1 billion of shareholders' funds, and he's just got to accept the fact. Instead, it's the usual, blame the short sellers, blame the system instead of blame yourself. So I think Eddie, surely now that he's sold his $50 million worth of shares, I can't see how he can possibly stay. But who knows how to run the world's biggest childcare company is the problem with that one. Now, the other one that's just happened, of course, is Opus Prime. Now, I think for your group, this is probably going to be the big one, because this is the first one that's got like Société Générale is a fantastic issue for your profession. Why wasn't it detected earlier? How did it blow out to be so large? Opus Prime is going to be in that category absolutely completely. How on earth did Chris Murphy rack up more than $100 million of losses? And how on earth did the founder, Laurie Amini, get in there and get his staff to basically shuffle stock around and not put margin calls that should have been put? Laurie Amini was in an investment vehicle with Chris Murphy. They together had borrowed $50 million from their own business for their own share punting. Very disappointing, the chairman, Peter Galluli, ran Tattersalls for 16 years. I mean, this is a guy who had to roll out poker machines across Victoria and all the systems and checks and balances for running 14,000 poker machines across Victoria. He would be ordinarily the perfect guy to be all over Opus Crime's systems when things were going hairy. And the way that it wasn't detected any earlier, when Tricom fell over and it staggered on for another 6 weeks. And even what happened when he left, he was on 2 weeks ago, but he didn't talk, he didn't say anything. There was no statement on the website. I mean, I really passionately believe in this principle of directors should walk and talk. That at the very least, if you resign with a public company it's disclosed, then you should explain why. And I think there should be a change in the corpse law for that, saying that the letter of resignation should be released to the market, to inform the market. Because when it happens, the insiders who know the director know that something's really amok. And the most famous example of this was Caroline Hewson walking out of AMP in 2001, I think it was, just before they eventually blew up $5 billion in the UK, about 6 or 9 months later. And in the case of Opus Crime, the chairman walked and there wasn't even a statement. So no one knew, and then bang, it was just all over. And of course everyone's now claiming that they didn't know that the stock was owned by the bank, and there's 40 or 50 listed companies that affected, and it's affecting takeovers and CEOs, shareholdings and directors, and this will have profound impacts. And I think that this has put the absolute nail in the coffin of one of the most fundamental conflicts out there, which is the ASX being a for-profit monopoly and being the regulator of the market. And I think that's gone. That's all over. And I had lunch here. I bought in lunch Eric Main, the Chief Supervision Officer of the ASX, 2 weeks ago. They're on the PR offensive. So I got the call. They saw me on Late Line talking about Eddie Groves and ABC Learnings. I got the call. Can we talk to you, etc., etc.? And, you know, we will die in a ditch to keep our regulatory role. It's important, etc., etc. I heard him. I listened to him for an hour. But I have to say that with change of government and with Opus Prime, I think he's gone. That there's no way that the ASX is not going to be stripped of their regulatory powers. And I have to say, it's remarkable that they ever were allowed to keep them in the first place. And I'll tell you how they did it. That the chairman of the ASX, Maurice Newman, was great mates with John Howard. John Howard made him chairman of the ABC as well. And the way they did it was they appointed Michael Costello to be deputy chief executive of the stock exchange a year before they demutualised in 1998. Now, of course, Michael Costello was Kim Beazley's chief of staff, a Labor luminary, so they covered both sides of politics. And then we were the first stock exchange in the world to demutualise and list on itself. And it has been the best single investment in Australia. If you were a stockbroker, if you were one of those original 606 shareholders, your $25,000 membership is now worth $5 million. So you've made a spectacular return on that. So in terms of monopolies, there's been no better or more lucrative monopoly in Australia. And this was sanctioned by government, and they were allowed to keep the regulatory role. And of course the incentive is to lower the standards, to allow all the complex CFDs, to license any old mug such as Opus Prime, to be slack on anything which is going to stop the revenues. And I think now it's all over, that they will be stripped and it probably will go to ASIC. But the big question then is, what's ASIC going to do? Because I run these lists of tracking ASIC's jail record. So how often is ASIC locking someone up? Because the ultimate measure of a regulatory, a corporate plod, is their porridge rate, is my argument. And last year was their second worst year in a decade. They only managed to lock up 17 people last year. And the vast majority of them were the usual, you know, the financial planner from Tuckerook. You know, the guy who's taken $20,000 off some grandma and gets his 6 months in the slammer and on we go. And meanwhile, Steve Vizard swans away, having done blatant insider trading, you know, still not stripped of his Australian, of his honour, you know, all that sort of stuff. So regulation in Australia, I must say, I'm pretty jaundiced about it all. But I'm pretty confident we're going to see some pretty substantial changes. Nick Sherry is the first ever Minister for Corporate Governance in Australia. I think he's going to be good. He's long had an interest in superannuation. You will see a few of the ideological issues coming through from the Labor Party. They are already talking about clamping down on self-managed super funds. It's the typical sort of, you know, we prefer the collectivist approach to the individual approach. We'd far rather have everyone shoveled into the union-friendly industry funds rather than being off there managing their own superannuation affairs. So you'll see a bit of that. The industry funds will be a big influence, but Kevin Rudd is quite passionate about about corporate governance, as is Stephen Conroy, who was the spokesman for 4 or 5 years. They reversed the proposed cut on ASIC's budget, which was an interesting, a welcome development. I can tell you, again, off the record, that there's also a group that are working to reform the AGM. And everyone's in the tent. I'm in the tent. ASIC, ASX, fund managers, a few lawyers, etc. And the idea is to go to government and say, this is what various stakeholders want to do with the AGM. And that is to separate the voting, the formal voting, from the meeting. So the voting stays open for another couple of days after the meeting. So the AGM is just an information session. So you haven't got poor Kevin going through the I formally move and I formally present and you know, all that formal stuff. Instead, it's just come along to the meeting, have a debate, ask any questions. This is the proxies at the moment. You can see where the hot issues are. Voting stays open for another 20, 48 hours. And then you will eliminate what is currently what I call the Davis Cup dead rubber effect. Where at the moment, every AGM is a dead rubber because 99% of the votes are already in by the time you turn up. So it's like John Howard and Kevin Rudd having their television debate on the Monday after the election because everyone's already voted. It's a complete joke. So I'm supporting this push for reform because just imagine it. Go to an AGM, you get told the votes, but then people can still vote. So if I can throw a few curlies up or if the chairman does a profit downgrade and the share price tanks, then the instos and everyone else can still punish that chairman with voting the next day after reading the press, after soaking up all that's happened. So hopefully that'll get up and that'll be a major reform. I know they're also going to go a bit harder on executive pay. They're going to get rid of a few of the tax rorts on executive pay. And I'm also hoping we might get a bit of disclosure of institutional voting like we have in the US. And I think ASIC's jail rate peaked at about 32 in 2003. So I think you will see quite a few people go to jail based on the shenanigans we've seen over the last 6 months. I must admit, I was just in the business centre over the 50 metres that way last week. And I bumped into Jeffrey Cohen, the former chairman of HIH. And you can hear his phone calls and stuff. And the one phone call he made was to his lawyer inquiring about some DPP documents. And this got me thinking that, geez, I reckon it was the 7th anniversary from when it went into liquidation. It was probably March 15, 2008 when I saw it. And it went under in March 15, 2001. And there is the former chairman still on the blower talking to lawyers about DPPs, etc. So when you really stuff it, these things can take a long time to play out. And I think we're going to see quite a long tail on what's happened in the past 6 months. And I think overall it'll be welcome. But that we will see a lot of the, you know, there was too much credit and too much crazy lending. There wasn't appropriate apportionment of risk. There was bad corporate governance coming back into the system. All these companies that have fallen over, most of them had terrible governance. You know, there isn't a case where I can say, look at this company, great governance, but it's broke. So you can usually point to the governance issues because governance is meant to kick in when things go wrong. You know, and when the boom was on, they're all saying, ah, we've got governance licked. You know, it's all covered. The ASX have done their corporate governance guidelines. That stopped government from doing more legislation because self-regulation was working and all the stakeholders were involved together. And it's all good during the boom. But it really has to kick in when things go wrong. So when Opus Prime has got their big clients suffering massive margin calls and the CEO is in the same position and there's talk that the bank, ANZ, also had a couple of bankers there who were margin loan clients themselves. They've been sent on gardening leave. So there's going to be quite a few classic governance failures that we're going to see come out from this. And I think it'll wash through and we'll see better reforms from this. So I'm quite optimistic that every 5 years you've got to have this reckoning on governance, and hopefully we'll get some good reforms that flow from that. So I've probably gone a bit over time, but feel free to get up and have another glass. And I'm happy to take any questions. I was very impressed to see there were 6 or 7 questions before, and I can say it's much easier sitting down there asking the questions than it is sitting up here receiving them. I was chairman of my local kindergarten for a year, and I only lasted the 1 year. I couldn't handle the politics in the end, and made a mess of the kinder. So, yeah, that's right. So I think I might. It's an interesting question: what boards I'm going to run for this year? Now I'm running for West Australian newspapers at the moment. Now the reason I did that was Kerry Stokes, the guy who controls Channel 7. He's the most supportive chairman in the country. Whenever I turn up, he says, "Great to see you, Stephen. Love your questions. It really makes the AGM better. I'm a real supporter of yours, Stephen." So I ran for the WAN board last November on the basis, "Well, Kerry, if you really like me that much, you'll vote your 20% stake for me and put me on the board." So then he's called the spill to sack the whole board, and I've sort of said, "All right, I'll throw myself in the hunt again this year." So I'm doing that one in a couple of weeks. I was going to run for Rio Tinto on the basis of more Aussies on the board, because I've only got 3 out of 15 Aussies on the board. And this is a London-based company which is only 15% Australian-owned, which has $100 billion worth of Australian assets. You know, the arrogance, sitting over there in Mayfair, running $100 billion of our assets here, and not even having a few Australians on the board and being based here. So I was going to do a bit of a populist tilt on that, but it was the day after West Australian News, so I thought it was just too much. So I'm trying to break open the Illumina Lunch Club, and I'm going to have a crack at the Centro Retail Board, but if they're still alive, and listed at the end of the year, on the basis that you've got to have some separate directors on the Retail Trust. And I will run for the ASX Board as well. I think there's a great opportunity. The best shareholder activist in the world is a guy called David Webb in Hong Kong. Now, he's very, very effective, and he got on the Hong Kong Stock Exchange Board, and from that position was able to drive some really good governance reforms from there. So he was just a Pommy investment banker who made $30 million, then wanted to invest it in the market, found it was pretty shocking in terms of the governance, started agitating for reform, got himself on the Stock Exchange Board, improved the rules, the market is more transparent. He's my pin-up boy. I mean, this is he's the guru when it comes to retail shareholders. Activist. He had a head start of 30 mil, but he's done a great job. So I'd like to give that a shot later in the year, and you'll like the irony that I've actually signed a book contract with Murdoch, so I've been sledging him for years, and I've taken my first 10 grand and another 10 grand to go when I deliver the manuscript, and I've got to have a chapter on Rupert Murdoch, so it will be very interesting later in the year when I submit my chapter on Rupert, Rupert's very sensitive about what his papers say about him and his family, so I'll be very interested to see whether it'll be a sort of Alan Jones ABC situation where they decide they're not going to publish it in the end, so I'm looking forward to doing that, and I'm also looking forward just finally to Nick Xenophon, the independent senator. He's going to be a real tour de force in the Senate. He's a very, very effective campaigner on a range of things, and he has a big interest in shareholder activism. He's a good mate of mine. I sort of work quite closely with him. He's flown me over to Adelaide for a couple of AGMs, and I've got him to a couple, and so I'm looking forward to working hand in glove with probably Australia's most politically effective stuntsman. And Nick Xenophon does all these stunts to draw attention to issues, whether it's pokies or whether it's shareholder issues. So I think that him in the Senate will also be a powerful force for good in terms of transparency, disclosure, etc. And John Faulkner is also fantastic for anyone who's interested in governance. He is a really good straight shooter. He's the Minister of State. He's the guy who's improving our FRI laws. He's improving the way lobbyists operate. He's improving the political disclosure, donations laws. So all up, I'm pretty bullish and confident that governance is on the improve in Australia, and that will be a good thing for everyone. So good luck in your professions. You're all very important governance professionals. Keep your CEOs and boards accountable. Be strong, be tough, be brave. Always consider your integrity, and well done for being in this space. It's very, very important, and thanks for listening.
You mentioned AGM voting. Now that's really interesting. I think it was the previous government made it so that unions couldn't meet together and on the day decide to take industrial action without the AEC and secret votes and all that kind of stuff coming in. And certainly there's no assignment of proxy. Can you see those kind of reforms?
When you contrast what unions are forced to go through, AEC, scrutiny, independent process, with the outrageous practices that happen in the corporate space, it is inevitable that there will be some profound change. Now, I'll tell you the two ways that corporate elections are rorted. The first one, and the most important one, is what I call the no vacancy rort. Where a typical constitution, and let's talk about West Australian newspapers, okay? their constitution says they must have between 3 and 11 directors. Okay. But what they and most other companies do when an outside candidate runs for the board is they also have a clause in the constitution that says the board can pick any number they like. And they always do. So they always say, I'm sorry, but there's two candidates, but there's only one vacancy, so please only tick one box. And in 18 of my 30 tilts, if I had got 100% of the directed proxies in favour, I still would have lost. And that is because of two factors. It's because the no vacancy rule, 50% is not good enough. You have to knock off an incumbent. Your typical incumbent gets 99%. So for me to knock off an incumbent, I've got to get 100%. Then you have the phenomenon known as undirected proxies, which is when you receive your voting papers for an election, you'll see that you can appoint someone as proxy, but the chairman's box is already ticked. It's already crossed. So if you just sign that form and send it back, that is defaulting open undirected proxies to the chairman. They average 10% in all corporate elections. Now that is the equivalent of the voter who walks into the polling booth on polling day and just says, I'm here to vote, and then hands a blank ballot into the box. That defaults votes to the government. That's the effect of this. So in 18 of my 30 tilts, there was enough undirected proxies given to the chairman that even if I got 100%, they could have got my vote below what the lowest incumbent director got. So I almost got elected to Woolworths in 2000. I got 58% of the undirected proxies. Woolworths the next year changed their, and they got me down to 44%. I got 58% of the direct proxies, then they used the undirectors to get me to 44%, so I was out. But the next year they changed their constitution to introduce the no vacancy rule. I ran last year, or 2 years ago, I got 3%, because they did the old, there's no vacancy for Mr. Main, please only tick two of the three boxes, etc., etc. So that has to be cleaned up, and WA News have done it. So Kerry Stokes gets 100% of the directed proxies in favour, but if the four incumbents get 51%, Stokes will not be elected, because there is no vacancy. Because the board have said, 5 is the maximum, because we've just chosen that number. So it is outrageous. You can't have scrutineers to look at the voting. The board sees the votes coming in. They can see which institutions have voted which way. So there's it's no anonymous voting. It's no secret ballot. And then they heavy the institutions, etc., etc. So it is a shock. So I'm confident that, particularly with Labor being more interested in democracy, that I've created a body of evidence about how rorted it is, because I'm pretty much the only one, you know, who runs regularly and has tallied up the figures and all this sort of stuff. And West Australian newspapers will be the case study, which I think will drive some reform on that front, and it's well overdue.
Stephen, you touched on a couple of points with New South Wales. Could you give us some information or your views on the influence that they have over the government process?
I think they're increasingly influential, that they're not just ticking everything companies want as much anymore. I think it would be good to have disclosure of institutional voting, like we have in the US. So, you know, you can go back and you can see who voted for the dodgy schemes at Enron and WorldCom after it's collapsed. There's a far greater forensic trail as to who supported what. But the real power in Australia lies with the proxy advisors. And there's two firms. There's Corporate Governance International, and there is Institutional Shareholder Services. And they get paid $50,000 a year by institutions to tell them how to vote on the top 300 companies. And so if you're running a campaign, you've got to go to those guys and get them to recommend you, and the institutions tend to follow their recommendations like sheep. So that is where the real power lies. And I'm quite close to these. I sort of talk to these guys, swap stories. I think they're a welcome thing because they are independent. They're straight governance research houses. So instos get compromised. And a classic example of that is when BHP and Billiton were merging, the biggest Australian shareholder was Colonial, the Commonwealth Bank. And, of course, the Commonwealth Bank was a major banker too. BHP, and the chairman of the Commonwealth Bank, John Ralph, was also one of the BHP directors taking out full page ads in the Fin Review urging all shareholders to vote in favour of this deal. Now, looking back on what's happened, that deal has cost Australia probably $20 or $30 billion, because, you know, the BHP assets have all gone through the roof, and, you know, the Billiton assets, you know, the power stations are being turned off in South Africa, and you know, all the value, most of the value is being, you know, oil price. So BHP shares would be 70 or 80 bucks if they hadn't done that deal. It was a close vote. Don Argus, the chairman, did the whole strong arm thing with all the institutions. He saw the votes coming in, he rang them. John Ralph put the pressure on. Colonial, the 3% of the stock, could have swung it, made noises about voting against, and then decided, no, they vote in favour. And for me, that's because you had conflicted financial conglomerates, i.e. a bank, which wants to keep its relationship with the company, and the cross-directorship problem of the same people sitting on the boards of the companies as sit on the boards of the institutions which hold the companies to account. So you really need to open up the directors' club and have a church and state separation between the group of directors who run the companies and the professional fund managers and those directors who run the money to invest in the companies. And that's why I like the proxy advisor model, because at least they are independent of the financial conglomerate institutions. Sorry, my answers are so long.
In your run for position on the board, obviously, you know, at some stage you'll be such that you're going to get a position. Do you see that that will curtail your activities because of conflict of interest, private issues, privacy, disclosure?
Depends which board. Stan Wallace, I went to see Stan when I ran for the AMP board, and he said to me then, you know, if you get on the board, that'll ruin your business because you won't be able to do what you do. Now, on the AMP board, yes, it would be tricky, but on the board of West Australian Newspapers, Perth-based newspaper, I mean, I managed the conflict with my wife. I had to sell my IAG shares because they have a joint venture. I don't go and annoy the chairman of the RACV at the GUD meeting where he's the chairman, but that's, you know, pretty low-level company. So it hasn't really cramped my style at all, but I've actually become a better informed activist just from being around the board and seeing some of the processes vicariously. Not directly, I can't obviously, you know, read the war papers or anything, but I sort of, you know, you pick up stuff. So it would depend on what board. If it was a big financial institution, yes. If it's just an industrial company or, you know, a reasonably single industry company, obviously I would have to leave those directors alone on their other boards. But in the case of West Australian Newspapers, okay, I wouldn't harass Kerry Stokes at the Channel 7 and 8 AGM, but it wouldn't be a huge blow. But yeah, I think I'd like to get on one and be a change agent. So get on a board, on a platform, and once they've instituted the platform, get off and try and go on to the next project. So try and do that sort of thing. All right. Last one.
You point out a lot of the concerns about the integrity and the governance in Australian companies. If you look internationally at the Corruption Perceptions Index, Australia and New Zealand always rate very highly as countries where there's good governments. Do you think that's a myth, or do you think that really everybody else really is that much worse than Australia and New Zealand?
No, I think that Australian governance is overall quite good. I think our political governance is better than most, probably slightly better than our corporate governance, although there's a couple of obvious weak areas in our political governance, most notably the political disclosure regime on donations. Like the US bans foreign donations, the Brits, you know, you have to disclose the amount you spend on a hairdresser. You know, you have to disclose where the money goes. In Australia, anyone, anywhere can donate as much as they like. It's not disclosed until 20 months later. So it's late, it's poorly disclosed. Anything over 10,000 is not disclosed, but Rudd's moving on that front. So that will make it better. And I think our media is not great. But the highest level of corruption, in my view, in Australia is the political deal with the media owners, which is basically favourable coverage for commercial benefit. And that's been going on for decades. All sides do it. And that's what created the Murdochs and the Packers as the two richest and most powerful families in Australia. Because, you know, TV licences and you know, deals which were bad for the nation, such as Rupert getting 70% of the newspapers. And that's basically a grubby, you know, sort of deal. So I think it's not good, our level of... So that our media is too concentrated and too powerful with the players. A friend of mine used to run Microsoft's Hotmail business globally, and he used to travel around the world to all the countries. And he told me a really interesting thing. He said, I can always judge how developed a country is by asking how powerful the five richest families are, or how powerful the five most powerful families are. So he said, I can go to Turkey and they can tell me these five families are really powerful. And for him, he says, that lowers Turkey down the governance transparency level because you've got powerful private interests. And his argument was that in America, Bill Gates and Warren Buffett have no political power. That they might be incredibly rich, but they have subtle political power. So the US doesn't have a sort of a corrupted political system. And if you ask that question in Australia, then I think it's not that pretty a picture because, you know, Frank Lowy, a great entrepreneur, but has made a lot of his money from gaming the planning council system for shopping centre developments, paying, there's cases all over the case of, him rorting community groups and a council officer votes against a planning decision and then he gets a $100,000 defamation settlement and changes his mind. There's, all this sort of stuff has gone on over the years and he's the third richest guy. Dick Pratt's the fourth richest guy and he's running a cartel. So, I think, and he's a huge political donor. So I think at that level, we don't rate that well. But overall, I still think, we're pretty lucky with what we've got, and I think it is progressively getting better.
Final question.
Yep.
Your presentation was really good, quite impressive and knowledgeable. As an IT professional, information security professional, what is the one takeaway from this presentation?
Well, I sort of think about this on the way in that I am an absolute IT illiterate. So I built this thing called Crikey, which is a website, which is, it's a very well-known website for sort of crusading journalism. So I sort of occasionally get asked to speak about, the internet and the technology side of the internet. And I always have to confess, look, I'm actually a journalist. And I'm actually interested in I was on newspapers and I still can't even set my video clock. So my personal IT is hopeless and my personal governance at home is, and in my business, is hopeless. On the accounts are late, I'm behind on my tax, all that sort of stuff. So I always say, do as I say, not as I do. For IT professionals, I would simply say, be as technically competent as you can, as someone who is completely technically incompetent. I think that the increasingly the systems, the knowledge of the systems, are what should throw up the breaches of process and the audit issues which should be coming up. But equally the personal contact, I get all my information from the personal contact, journalist ringing up, the sort of the gathering information, traditionally in the pub, not so now more, it's more on the email now, and just sifting the information. Whereas your industry, it's more about gathering the information from the IT processes. So I would simply say don't undercut the human element. That the human element for gathering information, picking things up from the way people are behaving, when combined with great understanding and knowledge of the IT systems, will make you an even more effective IT professional in the governance audit space.
I'd like to stress something in that space. IT space, yes, there's a lot of attention, but we're trying to deal with managing the IT assets and the way they work in the company. And my experience with a number of large companies is that the better they manage their IT assets, the more transparency there is in their IT, it reflects exactly what's going on in the company.
Yep.
If IT is all over the place and no one knows what's happening, there's no government, there's no consolidated reporting, there's no metrics, you can set your bottom dollar saying what's happening.
And I would say to you, Woolies versus Coles Myer, I rest my case. That the company that invested heavily in the IT systems has had far less scandal and has had a far better performance than the conglomerate which has had a hodgepodge IT systems, has refused to invest and has had poor business performance and poor governance flowing from those underinvestment decisions.
And they couldn't collect consolidated reports.
Yeah. All right, well, enjoy Australia's best club. $200 million cash they spent on this place, so have another glass of wine, and thanks very much for coming to the AGM tonight.